So the future. Of a given event. Now, if you draw the past life cone, then the inside of the past life cone is the absolute past. And the rest is part of the space-time that is causally disconnected from this event. So it cannot exchange information with this point. So the rest is a causally disconnected region. Okay, so point particle in Minkowski space is depicted as a line, which is the world line of a particle. And since it cannot move faster than light, then at every point the trajectory is such that it lies within the light cone associated with this point. So this is the structure of the Minkowski space. Now, since we include time multiplied by c, it is convenient to choose units in such a way that c is equal to 1. Well, we'll choose units by saying that c is equal to 1. I don't know if you are familiar with this system of units. You are. Okay, so I will not spend much time on that. Well, we always, when we choose units, we always set something to 1. We can set 1 mile per hour to 1 or 1 kilometer per hour to 1. We'll put the speed of light to 1. Then velocities become dimensionless, so we measure velocities in fraction of the speed of light. So velocity doesn't have the units there. The units of energy, momentum, and mass become the same. And one can use, typically in particle physics, one uses electron volts for the energy units, and they are become the units for mass and for momentum as well. So for this, we will also use electron volts. And 1 electron volt is the energy of an electron when it traverses a potential difference of 1 volt. So this will be our energy or mass unit. And for some reasons, it's conventional unit in particle physics. So typically, particle masses are measured in electron volts. And to give you an idea of orders of magnitude, the electron mass is 511 kiloelectron volts. And say the proton mass is 938.3 megaelectron volts. Neutron mass is slightly larger, 939.6 megaelectron volts, etc. So center of mass energy at LHC will be, when it will be fully functional, will be 14 gigaelectron volts. So this is sort of gives you the orders of magnitude we are dealing with in particle physics. Um, Now, in addition, we will also, because we will be dealing with quantum field theory, it's also convenient to set h bar to 1. So, which means that, well, basically, h bar is the unit of the action. Or, if you wish, so h bar appears on the right-hand side of the uncertainty relationship, so it's product of delta phi times delta x. Since we set it to 1, then the units in which we measure distances are inversely proportional to the units of momentum. So the units of distance, which are the same as units of time, because c is equal to 1, will be inversely proportional to the energy units or mass units. So we can measure distances in inverse electron volts. Which leaves just one single fundamental unit, which is that of mass of energy. So we will measure everything in electron volts. But one can wonder if one can choose units such that everything is dimensionless. And indeed, there is another constant of nature, which is the gravitational constant, Newton's constant. And if you put it, this to one, then everything becomes dimensionless. But then, okay, so all these numbers become very, very, very small. So the mass unit associated with the Newton's constant is extremely large. So masses of particles that we have access to now are very small, and so it's simply inconvenient to use these units. Okay, so that's it. Let me introduce the notations for distances and time intervals in Minkowski space.
Two events. Signal from one event to another with a speed that is smaller than the speed of light, right? Divide through by delta t, then delta x over delta t will be smaller than 1. If s squared is equal to 0, then the interval is called now or lifelike. And in that case, the two events can be connected by a light ray. Right? So there exists a light ray that goes from one loop to another. And finally, if the interval squared is negative, then the interval is called the explicit light. And this means that the events are possibly disconnected. Impossible to transfer information from one to another. The event is usually written through the Minkowski metric. And here I use the Einstein's conventions for summation of repeated indices. And also the metric is the diagonal matrix with components plus, minus, and three minus. So plus one, minus one, minus one, minus one. The principle of relativity can be formulated in the following way. So we consider the laws of physics are invariant under coordinate transformations that preserve the interval. So if we go to different reference frame, the interval remains the same. And this is the principle of relativity. So in particular, we will study field theories that are invariant under Lorentz transformations, which are coordinate transformations that preserve the interval. So if you substitute explicitly the transformation into the expression for the interval, you find that the transformation matrix should satisfy the relationship. So this is the defining relationship for Lorentz transformations. So, Lorentz transformations are matrices, or correspond to matrices that satisfy this condition. So, if written in explicitly matrix notations, then we can say that these are matrices that preserve the quadratic form given by the Minkowski metric. And such matrices for a group which is 4, 3, 1. So I was told that you have studied Lorentz transformations in some detail, right? So this notation, 4, 3, 1, is familiar to you. Okay. In fact, this statement that force of nature are invariant under all three command transformations is wrong. The point is that this group can narrow a little bit the possible allowed transformations. In particular, one can consider such that they still form the group. So in particular, one can require that the determinant of the transformation matrix is equal to 1. Then this corresponds to proper Lorentz transformations. So in the group theory language, the statement that this group is too big is formally said this group is not simple. So one can factor out some subgroups or transformations that are and consider a smaller group consistently. So in particular we require that the determinant is equal to 1, we still have a closed set of transformations, proper Lorentz transformations, which are denoted by S of 3, 1, special of the group with the signature. And this is not the end of the story. I should say that from this equation, if you take the determinant of the left and right side, you find that the determinant of lambda squared should be equal to 1. So which leaves two possible choices, either determinant is equal to plus 1 or to minus 1. So this, the Lorentz transformations can be divided into two disconnected halves. So transformations with positive determinant and with negative determinant. One can require that Lorentz transformations don't change the error of time. Okay, so this is again a discrete choice. They can either flip time directions uniformly everywhere in space time or leave it the same. So, in other words, there are Lorentz transformations that interchange future and past life poles, and Lorentz transformations that don't. So those that don't change the direction of time are called orthogonals. With a zero. Okay, and we cannot make this group smaller. So this is the smallest piece of the orange group that we can make. So in a sense, the arbitrary set of Lorentz transformations form four classes, which are not connected to each other. So this group called V1 has has four connected compounds. Right? So we have discrete choice of the determinant here, plus or minus one, and the discrete choice of changing or not changing the error term. Now the truth is that the laws of nature are invariant only under this small set of Lorentz transformations, and break well this two other types of transformations which can be added to this group, namely time reflection, which just changes time at every point in space and time. And spatial parity that changes the all of the spatial directions. So to conclude, we can divide Lorentz transformations into proper orthochronous Lorentz transformations. If you want to consider the all possibilities, then we should add time reflection parity and arbitrary combinations of these transformations for O31 group. But it turns out that parity and time reflection are broken in nature. For the time being, we will consider transformations. Discussion that Lorentz invariants in group theory will not very much depend on whether we consider small transformations. Yes.
Is there a way to define, like mathematically, what do you mean by no change in the direction of time?
Now I can say it in words. So at each point you have a future life form and a past life form. So, and these are invariant. So this is. These are invariant statements. The future is past is in Lorentz invariant statement. Right? So we can consider transformations that preserve the future life form. In a more mathematical way, one can say that we consider, so this is the connected component of unity of this group. So this group as a manifold consists of two pieces which are not connected to one another. And when we speak to the Cronus transformations, we are dealing with transformations that can be connected to unity by a continuous path. So we can make a transformation. But we can make a rotation through a certain angle continuous, starting with unit transformation. However, we cannot flip time in a continuous way. Right? So if you do a transformation that can be undone in a continuous way, it's clear that you never change future and past right ones. I don't know if I asked the question.
Right. But if we flip time, won't we get a negative determinant?
That's right. So, in a sense, so there are four transformations. One can draw the following diagram. So, there is transformations with positive determinant and with negative determinant. And they can be orthogonal or they can be not orthogonal. Now, so time reflection changes the direction of time and also the same of the determinant. So time reflections connect these two parts, and spatial parity acts along another diagram. So it is clear that using parity and time reflection, we can recover all the corners of this diagram. So in a sense, one can do bookkeeping in the following way. Yes?
Is it that when the line across there has the same terminus? Because you're changing the terminus and you're changing the direction of time.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Because the parity is passed.
You're absolutely right. Yes. So this is. Parity is. Yeah. Yes. Yes, thank you. Now for now we are talking about the Lorentz invariant state of Maxwell's equations. It doesn't matter much which transformations we are talking about. First of all, because Maxwell's equations are invariant under all of these transformations, including parity and time reflection. And also because we check only infinitesimal transformations. So we do slight change of coordinates and see if the equations are invariant. This is what we will be doing. But it's important sometimes to keep in mind that the Lorentz group is a little bit more complicated. These are vectors and tensors. So the definition of a vector is a quantity that transforms in the same way as the displacement vector. So we think that the displacement itself is a vector, the displacement between two events. And so this is called the contravariant vector, so one can introduce also vectors with lower index that transform with an inverse matrix. And an example of this sort is a gradient. So if you take a gradient of some function, provided that the function is invariant, we will get the vector of this type. Now, for that we will use a shorthand notation, u f, and in fact one can consider just the gradient symbol to be a vector. So this is a vector. Yeah. there is really no distinction between the two, because we can use the metric to raise and lower indices. So if you have a vector, then we can form a covector by contracting it with the Minkowski metric. So this would be over the pieces. And if you introduce the metric with the upper indices, which has a matrix that has the same component, then we can raise indices with some covectors. And these two operations come in. So if you raise indices and lower, then we get the same result, because the metric tensor satisfies the identity. Okay, so and so we know how vectors transform on Lorentz transformation. So any physical law should be written down in terms of vectors and their generalizations, which are tensors. So tensors are vectors with many indices, each of which transforms as if it were the vector index. So an example of the tensor would be an aggregate with three indices. And the transformation properties of this associated with vectors and tensors, because we can convert indices. If you have an upper and lower index on a tensor or some tensor expression, we can convert these indices. They will produce tensor of lower rank. And we can lower and raise the indices evenly. So these are the rules of the game that ensure that all of the equations that we write are covariant under Lorentz transformations. So they look more or less the same for reference frames. Okay, so this was mostly the previous notations, and now we will study the first example of relativistic field, which is the Van Vogt's law. So, since we want to have to preserve Lorentz invariance, and we want to deal with field theory, then our fields, which will be functions of x, position in Minkowski space-time, themselves should be vectors and tensors. And the simplest possibility is that the field is the scalars. His invariant looks the same on reference frames. So this is called the Klein-Gordon field. So it is a function of x of time and position in space. And we want to write down the dynamical equation that describes, say, time evolution of this field. So how do we do this? Well, usually in classical mechanics, the good evolution equations are second order in time derivatives, right? So Hermann Possler first. Newton's equations are second order time derivatives. Now we want to generalize this to include dependent space. So we want to write down some second order differential equation that will be automatically Lorentz invariant. And then there's not much choice. So if we start with second derivative to make it a scalar, the natural possibility, actually the only possibility, is to subtract the special derivatives, and this will be just the square of this derivative here. So this operator, sometimes it is denoted by a square. It's called the D'Alembert operator. And it appears in in wave equations. So the wave equation is just the condition that the D'Alembert operator I think on the function is zero. The Klein-Born equation is a generalization to that in the sense that we can add a numerical constant to the D'Alembert operator and declare that this constant is a scalar. So it's the same number of frames. So then this equation is automatically Lorentz invariant, and this is called the Klein-Born equation. So classically, Klein-Born equation describes some sort of waves. Because it's a wave equation plus something. Plus constant added. Now, we would like to consider a quantum theory of this equation. So, now if we were given an equation without spatial derivatives, we would know what to do. First of all, we would write this. So, this would be some sort of Newton equation. Actually, this would have been the equation for Hermann oscillator, and we know how to quantize oscillator. We write down the Hamiltonian, or better start with the Lagrangian, then write the Hamiltonian, then it follows canonical commutation relations, and then we can diagonalize and find the spectrum. So we can equally well repeat this for the Klein-Gordon equation. Although here, the number of degrees of freedom is infinite. So, you see that we should consider the value of the field at each point in space as an independent dynamical vector. So, in a sense, we can write that x is an index. So, value of different degrees of freedom. Indeed, it does make sense to write it this way. And then, we have just a set of equations for a set of coupled equations for dynamical variables labeled by some continuous index. And still, we can apply the same rules of quantum mechanics that we do in the case where the index is discrete and also finitely variables. So our first task is to write down the Lagrangian or yes.
The analogy with the harmonic oscillator, Schrodinger equation has one time derivative, right? This has two.
Oh, this is not this should be, so this equation is analogous to the equation U dot dot plus only the squared equals to zero.
Oh, I see.
So here, or better to say so, it would better analogy would be harmonic oscillator with a set of coupled harmonic oscillators. So if you have an index, plus omega squared ij, j equals to zero. So we have set of derivative plus some matrix acting on the variable equals to zero. Now, if you think of this Klein-Born equation, this is precisely the same form. So we have that the second derivative of the field, and then plus minus d I squared plus m squared, acting on phi of x is equal to zero. So this is, has the same form. So we have some set of coordinates labeled by an index x, and then the second derivative plus some operator. Now the matrix here is replaced by an operator acting on the dynamical variable using. Okay, so this is, in some sense, Klein-Born field is a set of coupled harmonic oscillators with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So our next task is to write down the Lagrangian for the Klein-Born equation. So it's very easy to write down the action, minimal action principle. Namely, if we consider the action, we should write down as a four-dimensional integral of this form, d u by minus f squared pi squared. It's possible to show that the Klein-Born equation is equivalent to the condition of stationarity of this function. Well, by the way, this is the only function of which is quadratic in finite derivatives, and which is Lorentz invariant. So it's the only one that we can write, requiring that it is a Lorentz invariant. So let's show that Klein-Born equation holds for this action. If you take a variation, what do we get? So, the first term. We get the derivative for delta phi, but then we can integrate by parts. So this would produce minus d mu unit phi minus m squared phi, and then delta phi is another factor. So here we use integration by parts.
Yes?
Sorry, why can't the action have the second derivative of phi?
Basically for the same reason as Newton's equations, it's the second derivatives. So this is the simplest possibility.
You might have to be phi box phi.
Phi box phi. It could have been, but then well, okay, so
I actually don't know how to answer this question. Why we have only second derivatives in the Newton's equation? No. This is a postulate. Right? You just say that on the first derivatives can. There is a reason based on dimensional analysis. So we will discuss it later when we will consider interacting field theories. Maybe then we'll answer this question in an intelligent way. Anyway, so if you start with this section, so the condition that the action, that the variation of the action vanishes is precisely the Klein-Born equation, or what is the variational derivative? You can say that the variational, that the left-hand side of the Klein-Born equation is the variational derivative of the action with respect to the field. Okay, so the action defines the Lagrangian, and from the Lagrangian we can figure out the Hamiltonian. So in classical mechanics, the action is the integral of the Lagrange function over time. So here you see that we have the integral over all space-time coordinates. So to figure out the Lagrangian, we just factor out the time integral, which means that Lagrangian itself is an integral over whole space of of some density which is given by this expression. So this is the naturally, it's the Lagrangian density. And this is the Lagrangian of the Lagrange function. But somehow, people always call this the Lagrangian, because field theory, the Lagrangian density in relativistic field theory plays a way more important role in the Lagrange function. And so we will also later always call this Lagrangian density by Lagrange. Okay, so then we can write the Lagrangian as separate time derivatives in it. So we can write it as 1/2 pi dot squared minus 1/2 gradient pi squared and minus 1/2 m squared pi squared. So this pretty much looks like we can easily separate here the kinetic energy and potential energy. This would be kinetic energy. Well, the Lagrangian is always potential energy minus kinetic energy. And so it's clear that the kinetic energy is this term, and the potential energy is all the rest. But here, notice that the potential energy depends also on gradients of the field. So, if you make the amplitude of phi very large, that will cost energy. But also if you make gradients of phi very large, that will also cost energy.
Anyway, we can proceed also more formally. We can define the conjugate momentum to phi by taking variational derivative of the Lagrange function with respect to the time derivative of the field variable. Right, so this would, what would it, we have done in ordinary mechanics is find the degrees of freedom. Although there we could use the partial derivative, but here the functional derivatives replace partial derivatives. And well, this is just phi dot. And then we can write Hamiltonian as usual, as p dot minus the Lagrangian. And so indeed, this term subtracts a half from, is twice smaller than this one. And this changes sign, so what we get is the sum of kinetic energy and potential energy. Okay, so this is Hamiltonian, and in particular, we want to make sure that the Hamiltonian, that the energy is conserved. So dH over dt should be equal to zero. Now, if I want to do this explicitly, so we should differentiate dH. Then we'll produce some derivatives here, right? And then we should use the Klein-Gordon equation to check that this gives zero. And this is actually, well, this requires some calculations, so it's not that easy. And first of all, we need to separate time derivatives from space derivatives, spatial derivatives in the equation, which is which breaks its nice relativistic collinvariant form. So this is not completely satisfactory. We should be able to check the energy conservation somehow in a covariant manner. On the other hand, energy itself is not a covariant quantity, right? So energy is a zeros component of a four vector, of momentum four vector. Time, with respect to which we differentiate, is also not a covariant quantity. So this is not a good starting point. It should be possible to formulate conservation laws in such a way that they are manifestly non-covariant. So let me therefore talk a little bit about conservation laws in general. And with the aim at reformulating them in such a way that relativistic invariance is manifest. So, suppose that you have some conserved charge. It can be energy, but not necessarily. It can be electric charge or particle number, any quantity that is conserved. And let's assume that we have some sort of fluid or a field that carries this charge, continuously distributed in space, and changing in time, so this fluid moves in a certain way. So then, how do we formulate the conservation law? Well, one way to do it is to say that if you have some volume of fluid, then the amount, the change, or the charge enclosed in this volume, is equal to the outflux of the charge through this fluid buffer. So so we can characterize the charge distribution by its density. And by the density of flow, which is basically equal to rho times the velocity of the fluid. So this is flux density. Charge. And conservation of charge means that if you compute the integral of density, then its variation in time is equal to the outflow of or discharge through the surface of this void. So we take a normal divide the surface into small patches where we take the unit normal to the surface at each point, multiply it by the flux, integrate, and this would be the outflux, of the charge through the surface. Now the surface integral can be transformed into the volume integral with the help of the Gauss's theorem. And then we will have the following equation. Now, since the volume was arbitrary, the only way that this equation is satisfied is that the integrand is identically equal to zero. So the conservation of charge then is equivalent to the fluid differential equation for the density and the flux, which is called the continuity equation. And the fact of the length statistics is called the continuity equation. Equations or non-relativistic, it should always hold once we have some pressure point. So it better be a relativistic invariant by itself. Now, how to see that it's a relativistic invariant? Well, for that we need to find transformation laws of the density and the flux. So that can be done. By the following reasoning. So suppose that we have some small volume element inside the fluid that moves with velocity v. And so if we consider the evolution of the fluid during time interval delta t, then it will shift by. So we assume that this volume element moves with the fluid, right? So it shifts by the increment, so that the distance increment delta x, such that d is equal to delta x over delta t. So the important remark here is that if we go into a different reference frame, then nothing of this, none of these quantities are Lorentz invariant, right? Because the volume will experience Lorentz contraction in the direction in which we change the on which we do a Lorentz transformation. Delta x also is not Lorentz invariant. Velocity transforms the ring quite complicated way. But if we multiply, then the delta t also experiences Lorentz contraction. But there is one quantity that is Lorentz invariant. Namely, if you multiply the volume by the time interval, then this will be invariant in all reference frames. I don't know if you're familiar with this statement, but the more volume is Lorentz invariant. This is because time dilation and Lorentz contraction compensate each other in the problem. And then, okay, so by definition, the density is the amount of charge inside this volume divided by delta V. Now, the amount of charge is Lorentz invariant because, okay, so for instance, if you consider the conservation of particle number, then if you go in a different reference frame, number of particles cannot change. It's, you can count them in the reference frame, they should be equal. Then to figure out how how this guy transforms under Lorentz transformations, we divide and multiply by delta t, and now this ratio is invariant, so density transforms as delta t, and delta t transforms as a zeros component over 4 vector. Now the flux is the density times velocity. So this is delta q divided by delta v times delta x divided by delta t. And so this will be the invariant delta q divided by delta v times delta t. Times delta x. So the flux transforms as a special component of four vector. So in conclusion, if we can unite rho and j into a single four vector, which is called the current four vector, or just the current. So zero component is the density of charge, and the spatial components are the vector flux. Okay? And from this, it is immediately clear that this equation is Lorentz invariant, because it can be written as four divergence of the current equal to zero. So this is the covariant form of the continuity equation. And as you see, the continuity equation is always Lorentz invariant. So it's a very general statement. It just reflects the conservation of some quantity. So it must have been relativistic invariant. Anyway, so anytime we can find a four vector whose four divergence is zero, we have some conserved quantity. Now, returning to our problem of the Klein-Gordon equation, we know that Sure. And momentum. Yes.
Is that for vector just the full velocity times the charge density or not?
Yes. It's for fluid it is. Now for fields that carry charge and fluid in different fashion than and energy and momentum form a single four vector. So we may wonder how we can energy and momentum conservation in this form. What is G? How to derive it from the Gren-Worden equation or Gren-Worden action? Well, there is a general procedure to derive all possible conservation laws for any quantum field theory, which relates conservation laws to symmetries. This is a very profound result, which has very, very important consequences in particle physics, that conservation laws and symmetries appear the same thing. So the mathematical statement about that is called the neutral theorem. And so I don't have time to give a proof today, but let me get formulated here. So suppose that we have some field theory and we have some set of fields. So A, the index I runs from 1 to n. So we consider more general situation in which we can have several fields or fields that are vectors or tensors. So this index, we know so possible compound or possible fields and there are possible compounds. So, and we also will consider the case where we have most general Lagrangian that depends on the fields. And on their first derivatives. Yes, so Gren-Worden Lagrangian is certainly that form. Let's be working. So then the equations of motion that follow from the variation of this Lagrangian formulate the following statement. So the statement relates symmetries of this Lagrangian with this possible conservation laws that are consequences of this equation. So symmetries equivalent to conservation laws. Now, first of all, we need to define what is a symmetry. Now, a symmetry is some transformation of fields and coordinates that leaves the action environment.
Any other question?
Yes.
That thing is just for translation, right? Symmetry are considering that.
I know
that is just the other language question.
This is just the question of motion. So symmetries are transformations, let's see, So symmetric transformations are okay. So are some changes in coordinates and fields that give action in R. And we consider symmetric transformations that depend on the parameter. Like, for instance, if you consider Lorentz transformations, they depend on the parameter of the boost or rotation angle. And so, since this parameter is continuous, we can take it to be very small. And in this case, we are dealing with infinitesimal transformations. So this epsilon is a small parameter of an infinitesimal transformation. So the statement of the theorem is that if action is invariant, then you can define currents that are constructed with the help of the parameters of the transformation.
Should be the same for every coordinate.
Yes, for epsilons are numbers.
They're just numbers, they don't depend on x.
They don't depend on x.
And the fact that this is infinitesimal is important as well. You can see this symmetry infinitesimal, it's not just, you like parity.
Yeah, parity will not depend. Okay, so we'll discuss examples and the proof in the next lecture. Yes.
When you got this data being vector, how did you value it actually?
Oh, you mean how to find them from the action?
Eating it.
Well, one has to check that these transformations do not change the direction. So if you substitute them, you don't know, phi plus delta phi and x plus delta x into Lagrangian, and this should be.
I'm talking about a killing vector. Is there, can you call a killing vector? What do you mean by that? Killing vector?
Sometimes they're called killing the horse.
Named after a German guy called Killing the
Horse. They're not killing anyone.
So apparently somebody somewhere in PI has been using BitTorrent.
Download stuff.
Someone's been downloading it.